Well, I'm going to be speaking tonight about the Vedanas. And I know that a lot of you are familiar with this concept, but for those of you who may not be, a Vedana is a Pali word, and it's usually translated into English as feeling or feeling tone. But it doesn't mean feeling or emotion in the way that we usually think of it. It actually just refers to the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality of everything that we experience and any objects that we encounter. And this place in our mental process where we recognize pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral has a pretty important role to play in the Buddhist teachings. It is one of the four foundations of mindfulness, as I think a lot of you may remember from Rodney's series on the Satipatthana Sutta that he did last year. And it's also one of the links in the cycle of dependent origination. And that's why I decided that it would be a good topic to speak about tonight, because it fits in really, really well with what Rodney is doing with his series. The importance that the Vedanas are given in the teachings actually really makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, the way that we react to what is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral just really has a huge role to play in whether we just kind of keep that wheel of samsara turning and turning and turning. I mean, to the extent that we're all caught up in what we want or don't want, and all of our plans to get the things that we want and get rid of the things that we don't want, and even more, all the actions that we undertake to get what we want and get rid of what we don't want, we really just are keeping going around and around and around and around, you know, sort of endlessly pursuing what's pleasant and running away from what is unpleasant. But to the extent that we can stop and simply be with what our experience is as it unfolds, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, then we can really slow the momentum of that cycle and have an opportunity to break the cycle. And so it's a very, very important link to pay attention to. And, I mean, that sounds very good in theory, but I'd also like to give some examples of working with this that, from my own practice, I've found it a really, really very valuable place to explore. I was introduced to the Vedanas pretty early on when I started practicing, when I was on a retreat. And as most of you know who have been on residential retreats, usually sometime in the morning the teachers give some meditation instruction, and they'll tell you, you know, certain things during that day to pay attention to as you're doing your practice. And on this particular day, we were told to notice the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral quality of our experience. And I didn't have much idea of why I was supposed to do that. And I suspect that the teachers actually told us something about why we should. But you know how it is sometimes when you're just not at that point where you're ready to take something in, and it just goes in one ear and out the other. But I was quite happy to, you know, follow the instructions. So I kind of went out and started my walking meditation, you know, stepping, and then noticing the warmth of the sun, pleasant, and the birds singing, pleasant, smell of some flowers that are blooming, pleasant, very nice. And then the sun went behind a cloud, and this kind of cold wind came up, and that wasn't so pleasant. And then I kind of kept going, stepping, lifting, moving, placing, lifting, moving, placing, lifting, moving, placing. And after a while, it got boring. And I think you all can relate to that feeling. Well, not very pleasant. But it occurred to me then that it wasn't going to be too long before the bell would ring, and then it would be lunchtime. And then there'd be plenty that was pleasant. So that made me feel a little bit better, and I was able to, you know, settle down and pay attention to my stepping, lifting, moving, and placing. So after a while, the lunch bell did ring, and I was all, you know, goody-goody. Went in, got my food in the dining hall in the line, and I went out and sat down in the sunshine and thought, oh, now this is going to be nice. I'll have all this pleasant experience with this food. Well, one of the things that we had to eat was broccoli. And as far as I'm concerned, now, broccoli isn't a bad thing, but it isn't a very exciting food. So I thought, well, okay, I'll have the broccoli first. It's not going to be that pleasant, but I'll have the broccoli first. So I took some broccoli and tasted the broccoli and, neutral, a little unpleasant, nothing to get excited about. But I thought, okay, now some salad. And they have this really good salad dressing, this hollyhock dressing that I think a lot of you like, this made with this brewer's yeast. So I'm like, oh, goody, I get this. That's what I thought I put on my salad. Well, I took a bite of the salad. It wasn't that dressing. It was this bland, blah, I don't know what it was. So I was like, ah, not pleasant. But they had this really tasty-looking curry. So I thought, well, now that at least is going to be pleasant. Well, took a bite of the curry. This was the blandest, dullest, most tasteless curry I'd ever had. I'm like, what is going on? Something is wrong here. Nobody told me that, you know, meditation was supposed to do something to your taste buds. I'm like, what's happening? Am I losing my ability to experience pleasure? Is this that weird disenchantment thing that they keep talking about? What's going on? But luckily, there was still one thing left, a brownie, which really, you know, like maybe twice during the 10-day retreat do you get anything like that. So I thought, okay, I'll have my brownie. Now, if this brownie is as bland as everything else, I know something is really wrong. I'm going straight to the teacher. But I tasted my brownie. Ah, it was pleasant. Whew. So it was okay. Now, mostly this is just kind of a funny story about how goofy the mind can be, but I think it's a good thing to remember that just the simple practice of noticing pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral in our experience, you know, quite apart from worrying about how we react to it, can be a really interesting exercise, and it can help us to appreciate just the changing nature of our experience. And we tend to kind of on a subconscious level assume that everything should be pleasant, and if it isn't, then it must be somebody's fault, either our fault, someone else. But if we just notice this change, we can see that things change. Pleasant comes up, unpleasant comes up. We haven't really been doing anything. We can't really point to anyone else who has been doing anything. Things simply change because of causes and conditions that come together that we may not really understand at all. So this sort of ties in with what Rodney has been talking about in some of his earlier talks about this very complex web of cause and conditions. Well, luckily, over time, I developed a little bit more mature appreciation for the Vedanas. And I had another experience with them that was pretty, you know, memorable. And this also was a retreat experience. And this was a situation where, for whatever reason, very fortunately, things came together. So I was experiencing a lot of calmness of mind and steadiness of mind and kind of a feeling of things being, you know, pretty okay. So it was a very stable atmosphere and one that made it kind of facilitated, you know, the possibility of really looking closely at the mind and noticing the pleasant and the unpleasant and noticing the way the mind reacted to it. And I remember at some point one of my teachers, Steve Armstrong, who many of you also know, said something like, you know, really, it's a long way from knowing unpleasant to, I hate this thing. And a lot of times it doesn't really seem like that to us, because as soon as something unpleasant happens, we feel like automatically there's that reaction. But I found that in this very much more stable atmosphere, I began to see that what he was saying was really true, and that knowing unpleasant or knowing pleasant and this reaction of not liking, not wanting, or liking and wanting and craving were really different things, very distinctive things. And while they often, you know, arise, you know, one on the heels of the other, that isn't necessarily so. Sometimes it happens, but there are times when the mind just is quite contentedly knowing what's going on. So it doesn't have to be this reactivity. I also had another thing that I learned during this was something about the unpleasant quality of the reactivity itself. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One thing that happened during the retreat, as sometimes happens on these longer retreats, I started to have these very, very pleasant body sensations, which is, you know, great. It's like, you know. And so at first I was just quite happy that this was happening and enjoying it and just, very nice, blissful. And then after a while, begin to notice this tension coming up in the mind, this kind of worrying about what's going to happen to this thing. Is it going to hang around? Is it going to get even more pleasant? Is it going to go away? You know, I was sitting, you know, in the meditation hall experiencing this and beginning to wonder, well, what's going to happen when I go to walk? Am I going to experience this again? And then I went out and went walking and felt some of the similar kinds of feelings. And then I was worrying, well, what about when I go in to sit again? Will it return? What's going to happen? You know, all of this kind of tension of what's going to happen with this feeling? Is there something I can do to keep it? And then at some point, a light kind of went on. I was like, now, wait a minute. My mind is so caught up in worrying about this pleasant feeling and being anxious about what's going to happen to it and whether it's going to stay and whether it's going to go. I don't even enjoy the pleasant feeling that it's there. I'm like, this is crazy. And so there was a kind of movement of the mind to let that anxiety and craving go and simply go back to what was happening in the present moment. Another example dealt with unpleasant. At a certain point, I was sitting in the meditation hall and noticed some unpleasant feeling in my leg, you know, this kind of tingling and a little aching, the leg falling, you know, how it feels when your leg starts to fall asleep. And it wasn't, you know, any big deal. It wasn't that painful. It wasn't that great, but it wasn't that big of a deal. And so for a while, I was just kind of sitting there and, you know, noticing the sensations and, you know, just okay with it, noticing the changes. And then as they went on for a while, this irritation began to come up. It's like, And this irritation got a little stronger and got a little stronger, and pretty soon the anger. And after a while, I was just furious that this feeling was in my leg. And then in this too, at some point, this little light went on, and it's like, wait a minute, this angry feelings in your mind are so much worse than this little trivial feeling in your leg. This is, why are you doing this? You know. And then, you know, this tendency of the mind to kind of come back to what was actually happening. And these aren't real earth-shattering sounding experiences, but they really made an impression on my mind during that retreat and helped me to just see these very important points that knowing the pleasant and knowing the unpleasant aren't the same as craving or aversion, and they don't have to arise together. That craving and aversion are very painful states. We don't always recognize this if we're so caught up, you know, in our righteous indignation about something bad that is happening, or we're so caught up in our fantasies about how wonderful it will be when we get this lovely thing that we want. We don't feel that pain. But if we pay attention to the mental states of wanting or not wanting themselves, they really are not very pleasant. And I think what maybe is even more important is not only are they unpleasant, they really don't do anything for us. I mean, you don't get anything out of these states. It's like this being wrapped up and caught in aversion really doesn't do anything except make what is already a painful experience even more painful by adding that mental pain to it. If we get all caught up in our craving and wanting, all this does is really spoil our ability to appreciate the pleasant that does come our way. So it's like, you know, not worth going there. You know, it's just not worth going there. And I think having a sense of that really, really helps. Somehow, when that is very clear, the tendency of the mind to get caught up isn't quite as strong. And we have the appeal just isn't there of getting quite as bound up in our plans and our fantasies and our, you know, attempts to get rid of things. There's some realization that really the wisest thing to do is just open to what is happening. Not that we will never feel this reactivity, but the hold on our minds is really not as strong as it once was when we see some of these things more clearly. And the examples that I gave really were from a retreat situation, but I think these kinds of understanding and learning are, we can see these things and learn these things just as much in our everyday lives. And in fact, I think often the place where we really learn about the painful quality of craving and aversion is in our daily lives. When we come to a situation where we lose someone or something that we're really attached to, or we can't get something that we've really longed for, you know, we're at that place where all of our schemes and dreams to try to stop something from happening or make something happen are working, and we're just stuck there with our very, very painful feelings. And at some point we get to the state where it's so painful that it really doesn't matter anymore who did what or who said what, none of that story. We just need to stop and take care of our own pain to save our sanity. And I think that's a point when we really begin to turn to the pain itself and take care of ourselves, and our healing can begin. So this might be a good time to mention that non-reactivity and just being with accepting what is happening in the moment in no way means passivity. It doesn't mean at all that if something painful or difficult is happening and there are things that we can do to ease the situation, to ease our pain or others' pain, of course we should do these things. Or if we have an opportunity to enjoy a pleasant experience that's, you know, something that's not going to harm ourselves or harm others, to accept that with gratitude that this has come our way. It's maybe more important to remember to think about avoiding reacting out of the aversion or the greed, because things that we do that are just impulsive and driven by, you know, hate and anger, or driven by just our obsession with getting something, generally are not going to lead to any place that's going to make us very happy or make anybody else very happy. So I think that is a really important thing to keep in mind. Also, you know, something that happens sometimes is people sort of get this idea that if they are, you know, non-reactive to pleasure or pain, that means that they're kind of sit there like a stone statue, indifferent to everything that happens and unmoved by anything that goes on. And there's this, you know, thinking, well, if this is where this practice is leading, and I'm just going to be this kind of dead thing with no emotions, that's not where I want to go. But I think that is really kind of a misinterpretation of what equanimity and acceptance really is. It's much more a state where we really are open to what is happening with acceptance and with caring attention and with interest. So in many ways, it's much more an attitude of love than of indifference or non-feeling. Sometimes also we get an idea that if we can't be completely unmoved and unreactive, that we should try to kind of create an environment where we can avoid coming into contact with anything that's, you know, too painful or too pleasant. I mean, mostly you hear people with this kind of idea when it comes to the pleasant, like, oh, I better not get around that thing because if I'm around it, I might feel desire, you know. And I think, you know, certainly there are cases where wise avoidance is a good thing to do. I mean, if you know you should reduce sugar in your diet, you shouldn't go out and buy, you know, half a dozen boxes of Girl Scout cookies, even though you tell yourself, you know, you're just benefiting a charity and it's all for your family. You know, it's not a good thing to do. But at the same time, I think we see that really there are many, there are other much more wholesome emotions that do arise when we come in contact with the pleasant and unpleasant. And it just isn't a matter of needing to stay away from these things. We may find that, you know, when kind of the hold of our, you know, chasing after the pleasant, trying to get rid of the unpleasant, and our fascination with our wants and our not wants and our likes and our dislikes kind of starts to ease a little bit, we may find other emotions just arising spontaneously. For example, if something pleasant happens, we may notice appreciation, gratitude, joy, that really aren't connected to much of a worry about whether this thing is going to stay or how we can keep it. We're just glad that it's here now for us to enjoy. Or when something painful happens, we may notice compassion arising, perhaps for ourselves, for the difficulty we're in, or maybe for another person. And when we recognize how much pain they must be in to be acting out and doing some of the things they're doing that's causing so much discomfort to us and for others. And in this connection, I think our practice of the Brahma-viharas can really be a helpful thing. You know, the metta practice and compassion practice, equanimity, sympathetic joy, this can be a way of kind of reminding ourselves that emotions like appreciation, gratitude, compassion are just as much a part of our makeup and just as accessible to us as greed or anger. And when we do our Brahma-Vihara practices, it kind of gives the mind a little kind of reminder that this is possible too, you know. Helps us to remember that those are places the mind can go. So that can be a very helpful thing in working with pleasure and pain, I think. And now I've been talking a lot about pleasure and pain, but I'd like to shift gears a little bit and move on to the third Vedana, the neutral. And I left this for last in part because I think this is one of the most challenging of the three, because it's so slippery and so evasive and so hard to get a handle on. In fact, one of the really classic responses to neutral stimuli is just to go to sleep. You know, we just go to sleep. And that can sometimes be actually physically, you know, going to sleep when not much is happening, but it can also be kind of going to sleep while we're awake, sort of zoning out and not even noticing what's happening, so we just don't even see what's in front of us. The kind of reaction we have when we get so habituated to things that are familiar that we're just on automatic pilot and we don't even see them anymore. And I think the mind itself, the way the mind works, kind of encourages this attitude a little bit, because we kind of, when, if you ever kind of notice when you encounter something new, how the mind is just all over that thing, you know, it wants to notice everything about it, see everything about it, it's just very wrapped up in, like, what is this thing? What is this thing? After it's encountered it a few times, it recognizes it. Often, you know, there's a name for it, has this idea of it. It's sort of filed away as something known. When you encounter it again, the response is sort of more like, oh, well, that's X. We know what X is. Okay, fine, on to the next thing. So we just kind of don't pay attention. And I think this is a place with the neutral neutral experience that can be a really interesting place to look at, is really starting to kind of get interested in just how our mind does this, you know, habituating itself and not noticing and kind of this whole process. It's something, of course, that, you know, it's necessary, because if the mind did not do this, we would be just so bombarded with stimuli all the time we couldn't function. But I think it's also important to recognize that it's happening, because if we don't and we just kind of go on autopilot, there's a lot that we miss, and we really may not know all about X, even though we think we do. Another very common reaction to the neutral is a kind of restlessness. This sort of feeling where we are kind of, you know, the mind is going out, sort of looking for something that's a little more juicy and a little more interesting to pay attention to. And we might notice this, you know, in our tendency when things are too quiet to, you know, turn on the TV, turn on the radio, check our Facebook page these days, or, you know, have a piece of chocolate or have that glass of wine or just do something that will give us some sort of a distraction, some kind of stimuli, maybe some pleasant sensations, something that kind of fills up the silence so we are, you know, not there just with too much quiet. So it really is a place where we can pay attention to our need for stimuli. And it isn't so much that a lot of these things that we do are such terrible things or such bad things, but, you know, it's good to notice the compulsion to do these things just to fill up space so we don't have to be in this vacuum where there isn't something more exciting for us to pay attention to. It's kind of like I have a friend that, you know, she had a very tumultuous life for a while, and then things kind of cleared up, and began to really go nicely for her. You know, she got a different job, a relationship. Everybody was thinking, oh, wow, things are going so great, so smooth. And then I begin to hear, you know, stories about, you know, kind of fights with other friends or, you know, certain, you know, things happening, you know, her getting into doing little things that were caused a little bit of stir. And someone else mentioned, well, you know, she just misses the drama. Mm-hmm. And how much of this do we all share? You know, we kind of miss the drama, you know, and that can move us to do things maybe that we wouldn't think we would do so that we have that kind of stimulus. Another thing that can happen when we're confronted with what is neutral is confusion. I think we've all had the experience of being in the presence of some sort of situation or some kind of object or stimulus that's pretty ambiguous. You know, we don't really know if we like it. We don't really know if we don't like it. We're not sure what we think about it. And it's kind of unsettling. You know, we begin to sort of worry about what should we be thinking? We ought to know what we think. What do other people think about this? You know, we begin to doubt our own perceptions. And the mind can be, you know, really quite agitated and indecisive and disturbed in this kind of situation. And when we notice that happening, you know, this really sort of gives us some sense of how comfortable we are with what is uncertain and what is unknown. You know, when we're faced with what's pleasant or unpleasant, we may not like everything, but definitely these things get our attention. We have a very firm sense of whether we like it or we don't like it. We know what we think about it. We really know who we are in relation to these kinds of things. And with the neutral, that may not be so clear. So I think it can be a very good place of learning about how we can solidify around what we like and what we don't like and really want to be in an environment where we can like and not like. It can teach us something about how comfortable we are, you know, with the unknown, with the informed, with the not self. And that's a very, very interesting area of investigation, I think. And so when you consider it in some of these ways, the neutral is really very, very far from boring, and I think maybe sort of the far frontier of practice in some ways. So I'd just like to summarize here some of the points I've made about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. You know, first that our experience, the feeling tone of our experience changes. And a lot of that really doesn't have very much to do with what we are doing. That's just sort of the nature of life. That there's a difference between pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and knowing, recognizing these states and our reactivity to them of, you know, liking, disliking, aversion, craving, and they don't always have to go together. That feelings of craving and aversion are not pleasant, and not only are they unpleasant, they're just, you know, not really a very productive place to go in much of any way. That being in a place of acceptance is not passivity, but really much more a place of acceptance, interest, and love, that we are able to also meet pleasant and unpleasant, with really beautiful emotions like gratitude, compassion, and joy. And that the neutral is a place of great learning on about how our mind habituates itself to things, about our need for stimulus, and about our ability to be with what is unknown, what is unself. So I would really like to invite you to explore this particular link in the cycle of dependent origination in your own practice and see what it has to offer you in terms of learning about what leads to more entanglement and what leads to maybe a taste of freedom. So I'd like to close tonight with a poem by William Carlos Williams. And it isn't exactly about the Vedanas, but I think it's very, very appropriate for the season and also is a kind of a nice metaphor for what may happen in our own hearts and minds as we explore this cycle of dependent origination. It's called Spring and All. And I should have made the type a little bit bigger, but I'll have to put it up here to see it. By the road to the contagious hospital, under the surge of the blue model clouds, driven from the northeast, a cold wind. Beyond the waste of broad muddy fields, brown with dried weeds, standing and fallen, patches of standing water, the scattering of tall trees. All along the road, the reddish, purplish, forked, upstanding twiggy stuff of bushes and small trees, with dead brown leaves under them, leafless vines. Lifeless in appearance, sluggish, day's spring approaches. They enter the new world naked, cold, uncertain of all, save that they enter. All about them the cold, familiar wind. Now the grass, tomorrow the stiff curl of wild carrot leaf. One by one, objects are defined. It quickens. Clarity, outline of leaf. But now the stark dignity of entrance. Still, the profound change has come upon them. Rooted, they grip down and begin to awaken. Let's sit for a few minutes. Thank you for coming tonight and listening to the Dhamma.